I am speaking today with Tom Reby about fire management policy. Tom is the author of the book Inferno by Committee about the Cerro Grande fire of 2000. He's worked for Bandelier National Monument on prescribed burns from 1980 to the present and is on the board of directors of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, a national group based in Oregon focused on progressive fire policy. He's currently executive director for Caldera Action, a group working to get the Valles Caldera National Preserve transferred to the National Park Service. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Tom.
Thank you very much.
So here we are, Tom, experiencing an extreme three-year drought in the Southwest, certainly in Santa Fe, one of the worst since 1950. And we currently have four or five even active fires burning in the state to the tune of about 100 square miles since May. So can we start by talking a bit about some of the dangers facing Santa Fe specifically during really any given fire year?
Yeah, sure. I think the thing that people, we all understand from living here in the Southwest is that fire is something that happens every year, and we've got a lot of smoke in the air every year. And what really is going on is the forests around here are all adapted for wildfire, and they're all expecting to have regular amounts of wildfire just from prehistoric times up to the present. And we are seeing the return of fire, whether we want it or not, into the ecosystems around us. And Santa Fe in particular has got a big forested area right up above it, coming all the way down to virtually to St. John's College, that has not been treated with fire for the most part for more than 100 years. And fire tends to return itself to the ecosystem if we don't put it there intentionally at a time when it will burn at a low intensity the way we want it to. So all of the land above us, with the exception of the Santa Fe watershed, which the Forest Service has been working very hard to treat over the last decade or so, is vulnerable to varying degrees of wildfire.
And so are you recommending a lot of prescribed burns? This seems to be a lot of your work, and it's a big discussion now. In fact, today in New Mexico, they're even talking more about also thinning in the Jemez. Is this something we need to do?
Right. There's basically two ways. What's happened overall is that the forests around the Southwest, throughout the Southwest, and the Rocky Mountains in general, have been deprived of fire for the last 100 years since federal land managers arrived and started to take care of big areas. And this was all well-intentioned policy that we've had in the past and really virtually up to the present. And what the problem is that forests get very dense over time. And I think everybody's heard this. I don't think this is news to anybody who's paying attention. And the reason it's gotten dense, there's both a combination of livestock grazing in the past and fire suppression, and in some cases, logging that happened in the past. When you log, you release the younger trees, and they tend to get thicker. So there are two ways that we can deal with this, two ways the Forest Service can deal with this, or the Park Service, or whatever agency you're talking about. You can send crews in with chainsaws and cut out some of the trees and either remove them or chip them or pile them up and burn them later when conditions are right. Or secondarily, what you can do is wait until conditions are right in terms of being somewhat moist and not very windy, and go ahead and ignite the forest in a systematic way that will keep it from burning very intensely. People know how to do that. It's a science that's gotten very, very well perfected now. And that tends to be, prescribed fire is a much cheaper way to do it, and it tends to be a lot better in terms of the way it adjusts the ecology and nurtures the whole forest ecosystem rather than just focusing on the particular trees that should be removed.
Yeah, but considering the drought here and the winds and the heat, is there a time in the foreseeable future that you can imagine when we could do prescribed fire so close to a city?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think the problem that we're having now is that to do prescribed fires, the fuel moistures, meaning how wet is the dead and down fuel, everything from pine needles to big logs, and how wet actually are the living trees. Those things are measured before any prescribed fire is done. And with this multi-year drought that we have now, it's difficult to find times when the conditions are right for doing prescribed fire. And this is a real problem for land managers right now, because it's, you know, they have to wait until things really get wetted down enough so that trees have really absorbed water and the dead and down is absorbed enough so that the fire will behave in a low key way and do the work that they want to have done.
And is this what is meant by progressive fire management policy? Really preparing these steps ahead of time?
Right. Yeah, progressive fire policy is something that's it's really a tricky thing, and it's been something we've been working on pretty hard since the 1970s in the Western United States. What we're trying to do is get fire returned to the ecosystem, get fire returned to the grasslands and forest lands so that it's playing its natural role again. And that's what's meant by the idea of progressive fire policy. And we're getting there with the National Park Service has really been the leader in this since the 70s, particularly on the West Coast, but also in places like the Southern Rockies as well. But what we really need to do is get the much larger land management agencies, the BLM and the Forest Service, to engage in this. And they are, to a large extent, more and more and more within constraints that we can talk about. I would give an example of the Jarosa fire that's up in the Pecos Mountains right now, right up by between Trucha's Peak and Pecos Baldy.
Which remains at 0% contained. It's closing in on 4,000 acres, right?
Yeah, and see, that's a wonderful thing, because that is a lightning fire, and I think we all saw the smoke when it first started. It really started to blast along up there, and the reason was it was in a lot of dead and down logs that had come from a microburst that had knocked down a bunch of trees a decade or more ago. And what the Forest Service is doing with that is very interesting. They're saying this is way out in the wilderness. It's not threatening any human, what they call human values, meaning buildings or power lines or antennas or anything like that. It's way out in the wilderness. It was started by lightning. And so they're basically just monitoring it and maybe working with it with a little water from the air here and there. But the idea is that, and this has already happened, rains have come and calmed the fire way down. And as the summer goes on, more rain will come. The fire's at 10,000 feet. And it will just sort of work along on the understory and eventually get put out by the rain. I expect it won't get a whole lot bigger, but we'll see. But that's a progressive thing to do. Say this fire is going to do the work it needs to do. It's not going to threaten anything or anybody. It's actually going to nurture the forest, so let's let it go and just sort of monitor it and work with it.
And that one is pretty far out there. No structures that are being threatened at this point, so it seems like a fairly easy thing to do. But what we're really talking about here is the wildland-urban interface and how we have increasingly moved into nature and into really kind of densely forested areas. So what can individuals do? If we are not in a position right now to do any kind of prescribed burns, what can individuals do to protect themselves and their property?
Well,
besides move away
yeah,
from the forest.
That's right. That's a really interesting question. And it's interesting because since 1990, about 17 million houses have been built in the fire zone, or the wildland urban interface, including mine, by the way. And it is a huge problem for the Forest Service, because all these homes that are built in places that used to be subject to regular wildfire are a problem. And we're seeing that up in Colorado Springs very dramatically right now. What the main thing that people can do is we need to be less complacent than we have been in the past. I think, like around Santa Fe, most of us who are living kind of out in the sticks or bit are mostly living in pinyon juniper zone. And that used to be the kind of forest that didn't burn very much. But we've seen pinyon juniper burn pretty wildly, pretty actively in a couple of the last fires. And people need to be mindful of, making sure their house is not built of extremely flammable materials if they're out in an area like that, And secondly, making sure that the trees are not right up to their house. Whether people like it or not, they need to thin trees away and have a defensible space around their house, at least 30 feet. At least 30 feet.
And when you talk about flammable materials, meaning any house built with wood, presumably?
Sure, wood, and around here we don't have a whole lot of that, but in a lot of places people have cedar roofs. We don't do that around here.
And certainly I would assume having an escape route, protecting your valuables, having a firebox.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of practical things. You talk a lot also about people specifically here in Santa Fe having this incredible aversion to both smoke and fire. Can you address that a little?
Yeah, that's probably the most important thing that we're facing right now. And I know this from having talked to a lot of land managers, both the supervisor of the Santa Fe National Forest and a lot of people who are working on incident command teams for the big fires. What's happening now is the public is getting more and more frightened of wildfire and more averse to smoke than people were in the past. The main point is the public really needs to accept that fire is going to happen in these forests one way or the other. Either we're going to introduce it in a careful way as prescribed fire or as pile burning, such as we've seen up in the Santa Fe watershed and saw in Bandelier in 2008, or we're going to have these wildfires that pump out a tremendous amount of smoke and are happening in an uncontrolled way. Either way, these forests are going to burn. There's just no two ways around it. And what's happened with the Santa Fe National Forest, for example, is the Tusuki watershed, we've got two big watersheds right up above Santa Fe. The Santa Fe watershed that has the dams where our water comes from is one. The next one to the north, the big Tusuki Basin, is one that feeds all the way down into the town of Tusuki, Tusuki Pueblo, and all that. And that watershed is in terrible condition. It's full of dead and down fuel. It's full of thickets of trees. It hasn't had any fire in it in more than 100 years. And that place desperately needs to have a careful, large, prescribed fire done coming from the top and working its way down. That needs to be done, and it's going to create a tremendous amount of smoke. And the public just needs to be patient and realize that this smoke will go away. It's only going to last a few days, 2-3 days, and then we're going to be in a much safer condition. If we don't do that, the one option is to do it mechanically, and that's pretty wild country, and people like the wildness of it. But if we do it mechanically, it's going to be very expensive. And secondly, if we don't do it at all, we could see catastrophic flooding such as Bandelier saw after the Las Conchas fire, where we could get big floods of water down through the town of Tusuki and Tusuki Pueblo after the big summer rains.
And so is this being discussed? I mean, are forest managers right now talking about how to do this, or is it a question of funding?
Oh, absolutely. The Forest Service is very aware of this. I've discussed this with them, the Santa Fe National Forest, and the problem they have is, the public does not like the smoke, and a lot of people get very upset about the smoke, and they ring the phones off the hook at the Forest Service office every time they do even a small amount of burning. And that's something that's really counterproductive. That's really threatening the safety of the community to have people not tolerate smoke. We have to put up with it. It doesn't last very long, and it comes and goes. And second of all, it's just a question of funding. Right now, the funding for these fuel management things has been cut by sequestration. The Forest Service, in real dollars, is dealing with much less money than it was in the past. And the Obama administration wants to cut about $100 million next year from the fuel reduction budgets. And that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it will result in less acres being treated and more communities being threatened by the sort of thing we're seeing in Colorado Springs.
And with all of these fires across the West, I mean, from Colorado to California, this definitely is not the time to be cutting funding from this, is it?
No, it's just it's just short-sighted, and I know there's a lot of people that are resisting that. We've seen, you know, like in the Jemez Mountains, we've seen a lot of fires, and the ecology is adjusting itself. And a part of this, I think, is because, not only because of the drought, which a lot of people say is cyclic, but we're really seeing a long-term drying out of the forests here. This is the worst drought that we've had since they've been keeping track, since 1880. And it's really fairly severe. We don't know when this will end. We don't know if this is a cyclic drought, which is natural in the Southwest, or if it's both a cyclic drought or one that is overlaid by the effects of climate change. The models for climate change predict a much drier Southwest. And Bill DeBuise has detailed this in his book, his recent book, The Great Aridness. And that's something that people need to consider, the fact that we may be seeing a long-term drying trend that's going to cause fire to be a much bigger issue for us over time.
There's also an article circulating by Jerry Ortiz Zepino called This Is Not a Drought. And we could be facing something much more extreme than what we're facing, and we're calling it a drought, right?
Yes. The question is when it will break. And this weather, the drought is governed by ocean temperatures and big picture stuff, which is very interesting, but there's not a whole lot we can do about it. And weather people just watch and say, boy, I hope the monsoons are good this year, and then when they're not, we all wait and say, boy, I hope we get snow this winter. And we have to accept that things may be different. Of course, let's just hope for the best and hope we get a good wet summer here.
Absolutely. So this is really, the key is education here. It's really telling people that you need to deal with smoke, you need to deal with a little bit of fire, because you may be getting smoke, but at least you will still be maintaining your house.
And
to be fair, there's also a lot of fear of prescribed burns going out of control. And this kind of takes us to your book. And you're writing about the Cerro Grande fire of 2000, which you say changed the course of wildfire management. So can we go back a little bit and talk about what happened there for people who may not remember this fire of May 2000, and remind our listeners here?
Sure, absolutely. That was a very interesting fire. It happened in 2000. What happened is Bandelier National Monument, the National Park Service, did a prescribed fire way up at the very top of Bandelier on the rim of the Valles Caldera. And for various reasons, the fire got out of control and burned to the north. Now, prescribed fires, only a very small fraction of them actually get out of control. But once in a while, it does happen. Just like everything humans do, it's risky. And that fire got out of control, and over the next 10 days, it burned about 43,000 acres. It burned about 235 houses in Los Alamos, and it shut the lab down for 10 days. And it ended up being what probably still is the most expensive wildfire in U.S. history. So that was an interesting fire because it was happening during a presidential election year, and it really woke the public and also the agencies up to some serious problems that were going on in terms of the way agencies interact with each other and how they address different kinds of fire. And the Congress had hearings on it. There were General Accounting Office investigations and a Board of Inquiry investigation. So it was investigated ad nauseum. But there was really only one very good investigation that was done of the fire. But through it all, it came out that the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, and the National Park Service were not communicating very well, and they were not working very well together here or anywhere else in the U.S. in terms of budgeting and deciding how to respond to each other's fires and how to help each other out when fires were either prescribed fires or wildfires. And that Congress basically told these agencies to clean up their act and fix the way they were interacting and make sure that they were being responsive and friendly to each other when there was a need for help.
Well, that's definitely a positive outcome. And we've spoken that kind of the superintendent of the park a little bit took the fall for that. But who may be responsible? I know that there are lawsuits in recent fires we've had here in Santa Fe, the Las Conchas fire or in New Mexico, as well as the Thompson Ridge, or was it the Tres Lagunas, was caused by a downed power line, and this specifically was the Jemez Mountains Electric Cooperative. Is anybody else to blame? I mean, people, this is such a litigious society, and are we going to start clamoring for legal action when all of these houses are being burned when insurance companies are having to shell out hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And just to digress to the problem of power lines, the last three big fires in northern New Mexico have been caused by downed power lines from rural electric co-ops. The Las Conchas fire was the most dramatic example of that. Tres Lagunas and Thompson Ridge. All of these were caused by power lines either breaking or being hit by trees and starting fires. And this is a real problem that we need to deal with. There's got to be some kind of design change or burying of power lines. Yes, it's going to be expensive, but right now we're paying the price for this in terms of the cost of these wildfires. And so I think the cost should probably be focused more on fixing the power lines rather than having fires burning at times when they're not going to behave well.
Absolutely.
So in terms of the Cerro Grande fire, there was a lot of blame on the superintendent of Bandelier National Monument, but you know what I found from the research I did for my book was there was a lot of different people who had created the situation where that fire could happen. And it was both of, mistakes made by the National Park Service crews that were doing the fire, but also mistakes on the part of the Forest Service in terms of how they responded and helped out. And a lot of it was well-intentioned. It wasn't people being negligent and messing up. It was people doing their best, but just the situation did not cooperate with their best efforts. But the other thing that I looked at, which was most interesting and may be interesting to people about my book, Inferno by Committee, was I looked at the whole history of land management in New Mexico, in northern New Mexico, going all the way back to the time of the Pueblo people, and how the vegetation and everything changed over time because of what people were doing and how we created a situation where we can have these massive wildfires that we're having now. And that was the thing that was most interesting to me, was uncovering all kinds of things I had no idea about that had happened in the past that had really altered the landscape. We take things for granted. We think that the way things are around us now is the way they've always been. But we've really changed the landscape, both in the valley here and up in the mountains, very dramatically since about 1880 or so.
Well, Tom, this is an incredibly important conversation that actually should be ongoing throughout the summer, into the winter, and as these years go on. I know you'll also be speaking on this topic at Journey Santa Fe on Sunday, August 4th. So if anybody has any questions or really wants to continue this, because there is so much more to say, please come to that lecture at Collected Works Bookstore. We're going to have to take a short break, and when I come back, we'll be speaking with Jill Gentry of the Food Depot about New Mexico's new status as the state with the greatest number of hungry children in the nation. Thank you, Tom.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
I'm speaking today with Jill Gentry, Director of Development for the Food Depot, which in 2012 distributed enough food to provide 5 million meals. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Jill.
Hi, thank you.
So just recently, New Mexico garnered another first place, this time for being number one in the nation for child hunger. That means that more children are hungry per capita in New Mexico than in any other state, about 30%, right? So, Jill, how did this happen?
It's actually, unfortunately, a title that we've held before. So this isn't our first time at the top. What we tended to see was prior to 2009, we had been up in the top ranks of childhood food insecurity for quite some time. And then during the recession, we saw other states catch up to where we had been, unfortunately. And now that there's been a little bit of a bounce back economically, we're seeing New Mexico right up at the top of the scales again at 30.6%.
And how is this measured? You will talk a lot about missing meals, but how is that determined?
Missing meals are basically the gap or the shortfall between where a family's income and governmental assistance like SNAP or food stamps and emergency food assistance like that given by food pantries through food banks. The gap that's left are the meals that could potentially be missed or are missed by different individuals within a family.
So we're really assuming that they're being missed based on their income levels.
Absolutely. We know for a fact you can put a valuation on how much an average meal costs based on economic conditions and based on a family's income and the amount of support they receive. There's a mathematical equation that can break down how likely and how quickly a family is apt to run out of food.
In this study specifically, so it looked at the shortfall of meals, 805,878 low-income individuals saying that they missed 117 million meals every year. So that's the equivalent of each hungry person in New Mexico missing 12 meals every single month.
Absolutely.
Which is fairly profound, isn't it?
Absolutely. The Food Depot serves 9 counties in northern New Mexico, and out of our 9 counties, this number has been broken down even further to show that there are 16 million missing meals just in our 9 counties alone, which is a tremendous amount. And a missing meal, if you think about it, is a kiddo whose family might be struggling, who goes to school Monday through Friday and might get free breakfast and free lunch, but when he goes home, he doesn't have dinner. That child is missing 5 meals just on the weekdays, and maybe missing more over the course of the weekend. So for families that have more profound financial challenges, you might be seeing a more significant number than just those 12 meals, but that's a pretty safe average.
So what is the role of the Food Depot?
We are the Food Bank of Northern New Mexico, which means we're the agency that collects food donations and financial contributions to purchase food with. And we distribute that food out to partner agencies, which are other nonprofits that have a food component to what they do. We currently have 135 different partners throughout northern New Mexico, and those look like homeless shelters or shelters for battered families, after-school programs for children, emergency food pantries, soup kitchens.
That is, there are 135, you say, all around.
135 partners just for us right now, yes.
And I've seen in a lot of the literature here that there are references to food insecurity and hunger. So what is the difference?
Well, to some degree, that sort of breaks down to semantics. The USDA renamed hunger as food insecurity several years back, and that's measured by rates of food security, so how able a family is to meet their needs through a variety of sources, whether it be governmental support, their family income, and or emergency food assistance. So some individuals have low food security, some have very low food security. For those of us who work in food banking and experience through stories the lives of people who are hungry, food insecurity is hunger, just by a fancier, more convoluted name. And unfortunately, that tends to confuse people sometimes. But hunger is hunger is hunger, and a kid who's kind of food insecure versus who is very insecure, still a kid who is hungry. And that makes a huge difference to us.
And it makes a huge difference impact on the child and his ability. Can we talk a little bit about how hunger impacts children?
Children are the most vulnerable to experiencing hunger. It has long-lasting, lifelong effects on their development, on their potential. Typically, a child that we see in school that is experiencing hunger at home can pretty readily be identified through behavioral challenges, difficulty interacting with peers, developmental delay, whether that be physically or mentally. We tend to see them lagging behind their peers in terms of academic performance. And if that hunger is experienced regularly between the ages of birth and 3, they find that from a brain development standpoint, it is almost irreversible.
And so I assume you have a lot of conversations with schools. I mean, you must be pretty close in
we
contact.
We do. The Food Depot operates the Food for Kids program, which is a backpack program. Kids in the Santa Fe public schools and in a few communities outside of Santa Fe, we're working on expanding that even further, get a backpack at the beginning of the school year. And every week, that backpack is filled up with non-perishable snacks that are healthy and highly nutritious, with high nutritional impact, so good proteins, fresh fruits and veggies when we can. And they don't require any cooking, so the child is able to feed themselves without any adult intervention. And that helps to close that gap between food that they might not be getting for dinner or food that they might not be getting on the weekends.
That seems incredibly important. And are these children, are they proud to have their backpacks? Is there some kind of shame around receiving them?
That's part of why we've done it as a non-distinguishable backpack in the past, so that they usually can't be identified. We do find that the kids are very thankful and will very often take that bag home and share it with siblings who aren't school age. So they may not be getting the breakfast and the lunch at school. So the school age sibling will share it with younger siblings as well. But we do offer it in a very hidden kind of manner so that the kids don't have to be shamed by that at school.
So heartbreaking, all of this. And you were telling me that these numbers are even for 2011. They're not even necessarily accurate for this year, and the economic downturn and sequestration, everything is really making the situation even worse. So are you seeing more or less of a demand for food, and do you expect that to change?
Since 2008, we've actually seen our agencies have seen a 30% increase in the demand for emergency food assistance year over year. The numbers in this study particularly reflect 2011 because it just takes time to collect data and there's always a lag. So we don't know what the exact statistics look like for 2012, 2013, but we have not seen a let up in the demand at this point. New Mexico has had a much slower recovery than some other states. We have not bounced back as quickly, so we still see that there are really definite challenges for people, and there's still definite hunger that is at a very high level. We're actually looking at some pretty serious threats to making that situation worse. Currently, SNAP budgets, which is food stamps by a new name, those usually last the average family about 2.3 weeks. And this week, right now, the House is debating a $20 billion cut in SNAP assistance. And that will absolutely change the face of demand that we see, 100%. We would expect demand to skyrocket if SNAP benefits are reduced.
And who are the people who you're seeing come through there? What is the demographic of somebody who is hungry, aside from all of these children?
Hunger is closer than you think. You would probably not be able to pick one hungry person from a not hungry person in the crowd. And considering that one in five adults in northern New Mexico are hungry and one in three children are hungry, there are hungry people all around you all the time, and you probably just don't know it. So the unfortunate part of that is that we serve all demographics, all genders, different income levels between very, very low and very low and low. So,
and it really can be the difference of, as you say, like a sickness or a broken down car or having to decide between medicine and food.
People make difficult choices every day. There's a lot of folks in New Mexico, especially northern New Mexico, where it's very rural, that are living paycheck to paycheck or something close to it. And one catastrophic event, you know, a roof failing, a car breaking down, someone having, you know, a pretty significant illness and being out of work for a month or two, or getting downsized out of their job or losing their home, can absolutely change the face of the economics of their family.
It is so frightening. So how can people get involved, and what can we do?
You know, we always hear sometimes the people, oh, I don't really have enough money to help. And, you know, sometimes the sweetest thing that we see in the mail is $1 because you know that it took a lot for that person to give just that $1. And from a financial perspective, we always take financial contributions. We're able to really maximize your donation. So please know that 93 cents of every dollar you donate goes directly towards food acquisition and purchase. We can also turn $1 into four meals. So that $1 does make a big difference. We will always take donated food. We would love for you to host a food drive. If what you have is time, that's extremely valuable. We can always use volunteers. We're working on a rice bagging project right now. We were able to buy a lot of rice in bulk at 16 cents a pound, which is awesome, but we have 48,000 pounds of rice that needs to be bagged into one-pound bags. So we need your help. But even if it's something as simple as you're a gardener and you really like to piddle with that throughout the summer and grow your own food, we love that. Please bring us your surplus. Plant an extra row for us.
And you were mentioning that, I was saying, you know, the summer, it is so plentiful, but in fact, you get most of your donations during the winter months.
We do. The holiday season tends to bring out the charitable side in everyone, and we really have a lot of folks that host food drives and so forth, but we do see donations taper off during the spring and definitely throughout the summer. And we try to send the message that hunger doesn't take a vacation. The people that were hungry in December are still very hungry in June. And we would very much appreciate anyone that wants to host a food drive or just increase our food donations throughout this time of year.
Now, there was also, though, you said there's an age limit. As the mother of a six-year-old, there's an age limit for volunteering, correct?
We are trying to sort of hold the limit for general volunteerism through the summer at around 12. We are looking at having sort of a mommy and me or a daddy and me volunteer day where we could have younger children come in with their parent or guardian and do a little volunteer project that's more appropriate for their age and making sure that they're safe.
And also just to have children learning about this issue. I mean, I remember I was so profoundly impacted. You all had an insert in the New Mexican. I think it was a whole series done by Deborah Bluesmeyer, mm-hmm. which was just amazing. And I read it with my son. And I was so stunned. But just this idea, and these were personal narratives. It was beautifully written, really descriptive of how some of these people live without food. And, you know, so many of us are following so many different issues here about forest fires and politics and everything. And food, food safety, food security. I mean, this is not about GMO or not. This is about we don't have food to eat. How can this happen in this country?
It's really amazing. One of the most appalling statistics I think I've heard in the last 3 months is that America wastes approximately 50% of the food it produces.
Oh, God.
And when I look at how many people we know are hungry just in our community, it is astounding to me that we could be throwing away so much food. So food banks like the Food Depot are there to recover food that might otherwise get thrown out by grocery stores or plowed under by farmers. And the more we can spread the word that you can bring us that extra food so that we can get it in the bellies of people who are hungry, we got to change this just one person at a time.
And you've said you take any food, nutritious or not nutritious. I mean, preferably nutritious. But
when it comes to donations, we will accept absolutely anything. We don't make that choice for others. We just want to offer choice. But we do have a very high focus on nutrition. So out of the 4 million pounds of food that we distributed last year, about 51% of that was fruits and vegetables. So it's not just cans of Chef Boyardee ravioli. There's a lot of thought going into what we try to provide to our clients, but we will never turn food away.
And is there any kind of cooperation with restaurants here? I mean, speaking of food waste, you know, all of these places that deal with immense amounts of food.
Restaurants are a real challenge because of food safety issues. So when food has already been prepared, that gets very sticky. We've tried to create alliances between some of the restaurants and the soup kitchens and the hot meal programs that are in town so that they can work directly to rescue that. And the main purpose of that is that it closes the time gap between when it was prepared and how long it's been sitting. If we were to pick that up and act as a middle person in that, it would definitely put us in sort of a hazard. So we focus more on food that comes from grocery stores and from other major retailers that are pulling something off their shelf because maybe it's not pretty.
Right.
Or maybe it's a little too close to its expiration date.
The box is dented, something
exactly.
like this. And where do you get the majority of your funding?
We really rely on individuals. So we get the majority of our funding from individuals, foundations, and businesses. And we have a tremendous amount of community support, which we're very, very thankful for. And we just can't say enough how we couldn't do the work we do if it wasn't for that support.
And you all, now you are not the ones who give out food, but you are partnering with a place that actually gives out a bag of food every Thursday morning, I think. Is this the food pantry?
Yeah, we work with several food pantries in Santa Fe. One of them is Food for Santa Fe. They give out bags on Thursday mornings between 6 and 9. Over on Siler Road, and that is a drive-through food pantry. They give out about 900 bags a week. But we also... 900 bags, and it goes fast. So
it's really first come, first serve.
Absolutely. So they do 900 bags, and if that means that if they're gone by 7 a.m., then that's when they're done. So, but we work
and
with
And what's in these bags? I'm sorry.
Oh, they have a variety of food. They have eggs, usually a little bit of fresh produce, you know, some canned food, pastas, whatever happens to be available. So we work with about 60 different agencies in Santa Fe, though, and several of them are food pantries similar to this one.
And so people could find all of this information. If you're not necessarily in Santa Fe, if you're further north, you have all of this information on your website?
All the information is on our website. There's a link for how to find help, and we have a very exhaustive list of all the different food pantries, the days and times they operate, when the hot meal programs operate. And we really encourage people to develop a relationship at a single pantry and just go there regularly so that they can receive as much assistance as possible.
And can you tell us from these studies some of the counties in New Mexico or in the north that might be the most impacted?
You know, rural communities have a really hard time, so their percentage doesn't necessarily reflect the direness of the situation because there's such a gap between how far away food is maybe from where they live. But Colfax County is definitely up at the top at 17%, Mora County at 18.2%, Taos County at 17.7%, and that's a pretty...
Even Taos.
That's a really common misnomer, that Taos doesn't have a problem. They have a very high rate of food insecurity in Taos, and there's a pretty significant gap between what our perception is and what the reality is.
And so you would ship the food up there, or would you encourage farmers also to grow extra food in that area to provide?
We do a little bit of both. We have several agencies that we're partnered with up in Taos. We deliver about 25% of the food that we distribute every year goes to Taos County.
25%?
25%. We distribute a tremendous amount of food up there, and the pantries are very busy trying to meet the need that is there. So we definitely want people to know that we're way beyond Santa Fe. This isn't just about feeding Santa Fe. It's about feeding northern New Mexico.
And how is Santa Fe? How is the hunger here?
The hunger in Santa Fe County is 14.9%, but we have a higher population, so you see a greater density of people who need assistance.
And you just wouldn't think that with this and this kind of view of a fairly wealthy community here.
Absolutely. We've had many, many people say, there's no hunger in my community. There's no hunger here. Or people from outside say, we're not going to give money to Santa Fe. You guys aren't hungry. That's ridiculous. And the truth is we serve way beyond Santa Fe. And the truth is also that there very much are hungry people in Santa Fe.
And some of the other populations that have lower incidents, Los Alamos, Catron. It says here they actually have no missing meals, according to the study. Is that correct?
That's complicated.
Okay. So maybe it's negligible, statistically speaking.
Yeah. It might not be statistically significant. So it really depends on, you know, populations and where they're accessing food and how the study was able to capture true data in an area.
And so you also mentioned that there is a new program that you all are considering about diapers.
Yes, we're actually working with the Brindle Foundation to launch the Diaper Bank. And it's an interesting thing when you look at hunger. There's really complicated economic issues at work. And we've operated the infant supply program for a long time to help give supplemental materials to families that are in need. And basically it's all about just freeing up money in the budget for food. So the Diaper Bank focus is around a couple of things. One, that families that want to be able to put their child in daycare have to have access to disposable diapers or they can't. So if you need someone to be working to bring more money into the family, you have to have access to disposable diapers. But that can cost you $160 to $200 a month.
Absolutely.
So that's a challenge also. So what we're trying to do is bridge that gap so that we can enable people to handle their own economic future by being able to go to work and be at work and bring in a little extra income for their families and hopefully, you know, grow out of an economic deprivation situation.
So it's just taking one more factor out of it. If you have to decide between food and diapers, then you can at least have that taken care of.
Exactly. And that will, you know, WIC doesn't cover the cost of diapers. So there's not really a safeguard to help you get into diapers if you are having a financial challenge. So we just want to eliminate another barrier and make it a little more possible for people to do better for themselves and their families.
That's such good work. Now, are you being supported by the state, and how is state government attacking this problem as well?
Well, the city was gracious enough to grant us the land that we built our new facility on.
Very nice. That's
amazing. It was a wonderful gift, but times have been hard for governments as well, and there's not been really significant money at the city, state, or county level to assist with these types of programs. So less than 5% of our total operating budget comes from city or other governmental sources. So we don't think that that will be like that forever. We just know it's been really tough times, and we have really great relationships with a lot of different representatives, and we get a lot of support for that, and we're sure that as the economic tide turns that we're going to be able to get a little more assistance as well.
And Susanna speaks a lot about child safety and child protection. Can she step in and say, no, we won't be cutting this food program here? Or is there any room for that?
Everybody who can be a voice for the Food Depot and for childhood hunger and hunger in general is a voice that is necessary. So right now we really need people to push at the legislative end, call your representative, whether that be Ben Ray Lujan, for most of the people that are probably listening today. Send a little email, take 2 minutes to make a phone call and tell them how important SNAP benefits are to, you know, we're already at the worst ranking in the nation. If they cut SNAP benefits, the rate is going to go sky high. So that makes a huge difference. But always contact your legislators and your representatives and your governor and tell them how important and how real this issue is. And we just need 1,000 voices saying the same thing.
Or more than 1,000.
Or more than 1,000.
So. Absolutely. And come and help at the Food Depot. Do community work really will make you feel better, and it will certainly help out. And the work you all do is just incredible. So
thank you
so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we're going to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to have a quick update from City Councilor Patty Bechet about her bill to ban large capacity magazines in Santa Fe. That bill will be voted on next Wednesday night at the City Council meeting. Jill, thank you so much for being
here. Thank you for having me.
I'm Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte, and I'm speaking this morning with City Councilor Patty Bechet, who's introduced a bill to ban large-capacity magazines in Santa Fe. That bill is going to be voted on next Wednesday, June 26th, at the City Council meeting. Thank you for being here, Patty.
Good morning.
So, can you tell us about this bill?
Yes, they're actually... We call them large-capacity ammunition feeding devices. They're not the ammunition. They're actually the feeding device that allows for multiple rounds of ammunition to be fired. And in general, they've been considered... back in 2004, when they did not renew the Assault Weapons Act, it was the law of the land in our nation. We had... new magazines containing more than 10 rounds were banned under the Federal Assault Weapons Act. And it was not, Congress did not renew the law despite widespread support from over 70% of the Americans. And as we know, we have a large and effective lobby on the, the NRA has been very effective, and very little is being done at this point, both at the federal and state levels, in terms of common sense gun regulation. And so, when I took a look at what I believe our constitution in New Mexico does not mention anything about these feeding devices. So the hope is that we'll be able to, at the municipal level, make more than a grand statement, but really try and make sure that folks know that these, these ammunition magazines, they've been used in Tucson, Virginia Tech, Fort Hood, and Columbine, and those mass murders.
Right?
Yeah, and what they do is they enable the shooter to quickly and efficiently, without reloading, and that's the key piece, to take down a lot of innocent people. And so, including in Arizona, the shooter was able to be taken out when they stopped to reload. So the hope is that, ideally, things would be happening at the national level, and even at the state level, we fail to really improve our background check laws. And so we're trying here at the grassroots level, which is what I consider the municipal level, to send a very strong statement that, we want to be heard. We would like action at the national level, and we would like better laws to protect particularly our children in the schools. I mean, the answer from the NRA has been to... just arm guards, in the schools. And so...
Oh, it's terrifying. Or provide bulletproof backpacks, I saw.
Right, right. More ways to sell things, in an armored world. And so we're just hoping to really... people have said, well, you still can get these things on the internet, and, you can get them in Texas. I mean, good news is that Colorado and Connecticut, where they've experienced some of the worst massacres, have taken matters in their own hands and passed laws, both outlawing assault weapons and the ammunition. But this is particularly targeted to the feeding devices because we understand that the New Mexico Constitution does not allow municipalities to deal with the weapons themselves, nor probably the ammunition. But this is particular to the feeding devices,
right,
which enables, the massive amount of rounds. And so, we're hearing from lots of folks on both sides of the issue, from in and out of the state of New Mexico.
Now, this is going to be voted on next Wednesday, June 26th, at the City Council meeting, correct?
That's right.
And I've heard a lot of argument, and I know we're going to have to go really quickly, but if anybody wants to say anything to their city councilors, write, I assume you're getting a lot of feedback from the NRA,
yes,
or NRA-organized people.
Right. And then there's been the other, the proponents as well have been writing from throughout the state and outside the state. Honestly, there's one gentleman that I plan on talking to tomorrow who runs an outdoorsman, the gun shop, and he has put a particular group of folks together with a petition to let us know how they feel. from in and out of New Mexico. And, you know, I plan on meeting with him. But hope people come down and at least participate.
Next Wednesday, June 26th. Thank you so much, Patty Bechet, for being here. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is...